his consternation, because he had already been picked by the leading citizens to go to Washington. But his friendly rival fur trader, Henry Moore Rice, also ran in that election. And partly for kind of parochial reasons, again, Sibley went down here, Mendota, I think the largest settlement was probably Stillwater, but there was some activity further west. And Rice was kind of more of a fur trader up in that area and had more contacts there. So he pressed for a polling place to be held kind of further northwest, I think Rum River, if I'm not mistaken. And also, one interesting aside, he pushed for the give the right to vote to what they call at the time the French, which was really the Métis, the descendants of French and Indians who were living in that area. And apparently at the time the right to vote was given to the Métis or Hawksbreeds, yeah, like that, the Métis. They were given the right to vote if they had adopted the white man's ways. So a very kind of a fluid standard to see whether somebody has the right to vote. And apparently the way that was enforced at polling places was if they were wearing white man's clothing. So rumor has it that there was one pair of trousers that went through this entire village, and one member would go in and vote wearing trousers because that made him technically European, and then he would return to the village and give the trousers to somebody else. So I don't know if that's a true story or a possible story, but anyway, that the French were up there voting for Rice. Sibley was a little bit mixed by that. He brought it up to the Secretary Caitlin, who said, well, take it up after the election with the Board of Supervisors. But it turned out he didn't have to because he got the majority of the vote. And there was also one write-in candidate from the Stillwater area. So you can tell it wasn't just these lofty ideals. It was partly they had this lofty ideal of wanting to send somebody to Washington to be able to procure statehood. But in addition to those lofty ideals, there was a lot of very parochial, very, very much the politics of the day that was going on. But notwithstanding all that, Sibley won the election. Now, if you remember, the election was held on October 30th. And so that's getting pretty late in the year. So the steamboats were, so by the time the election took place, by that time the steamboats were no longer running by the time Sibley was getting ready to go to Washington. And I should point out that the main means of commerce at the time and communications was the steamboats along the Mississippi River. They stopped at Mendota and St. Paul up in Mississippi. And the main points that they came from were Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and Galena, Illinois. So if you ever read about the history of those early days, you'll see a lot of references to those two towns, Prairie du Chien and Galena, because they were kind of the outposts of civilization. And then the steamboat came up here. And one steamboat you'll hear the name of quite often is the Dr. Franklin. That was kind of I don't know if it was the only one, but it was kind of the lead boat. And that was kind of a lifeline back to the rest of civilization. But it was late in the year, and you know the river was getting ready to ice up, so they had missed the last boat of the year. So it was actually kind of an arduous journey that Sibley and his family made. I forget exactly when it was, but the election was October 30th, so you know, we'll assume a couple of weeks to get packed up and whatever. So they actually went by sled as far as Prairie du Chien, making their way to Washington. And there was a lot of there was some anticipation in Washington. People were wondering what kind of had come here in the 1820s, when it was, I believe it was still Michigan territory. And his, and Sibley was very learned in law. He had studied law. And he was a pretty, I think, astute businessman and lawyer. He didn't apparently argue too many cases in the Supreme Court. I haven't seen his name as a party or an attorney there. As a party, it's in the land title things. But he seems to be a pretty astute attorney. And if you ever look at the speech, and it's available online in the materials here out of the link board, you can see he's a pretty astute attorney on top of everything else. But his father was actually the Chief Justice of the Michigan Territory Supreme Court for over a decade. That's where I'm going to kind of depart a little bit from what the lead historians say. Because the main historians are Blavian and William Watts Falwell. And they kind of talk about, well, this was just a legal fiction. We know this territory didn't really exist, but they needed to send somebody to Washington. So they did that, and everybody kind of looked the other way. Well, I don't think that's really the case, because I think there's more to it than that. I think it was a pretty legitimate argument that he made, that maybe, carrying the name of Wisconsin Territory is not it. But you have all these settlers out here settled in reliance on there being some government, and they're entitled to some representation, some kind. So I think that's reasonable. That's interesting. That Minnesota kind of began by its residents clamoring for more government. We need more government. So that's sort of something that things changed a little bit over the years. One kind of a legal technicality that never really was like that. As I mentioned, Sibley was from Mendota. And Mendota is actually on the other side of the river, so he was actually a resident of Iowa Territory, if anything. He was not a resident of the Wisconsin Territory that he was purporting to represent, but nobody seemed to notice that. When I was in college, I did some research on the topic kind of around this. It was kind of interesting. If you look at the Sibley's papers, which are all fully cataloged at the Historical Society, you see letters. Remember, okay, Iowa was invented in 1846. Well, if you see letters addressed to Sibley in, for example, 1847, they are addressed to St. Peter's, Iowa Territory. So just in the public parlance, just sitting down and addressing a letter, you put something on it, and that's what people were using. So again, I think there's a little bit more evidence that these territories continue to exist. Well, anyway, he did go to Washington during the winter, and thanks largely to his work on March 3rd, 1849, the Organic Act creating the Minnesota Territory was passed. Again, you have to think in the context of what else was going on at that time. Well, the Civil War was just 12 years away, so obviously that was the main political issue of the time. So the opposition to his being ceded and the opposition to this new territory being created came largely from members of Congress in the southern states, because what he was doing was setting into motion the process for creating a new free state. And again, under the Northwest Ordinance, this land was in perpetuity to be free of slavery, so there was really no question that it would not be a slave state.